ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, Joe Biden gives his all-important State of the Union address. Will it be enough to convince American voters they should back him in November? Also, this International Women's Day, the fight for gender equality continues. And with fuel efficiency laws coming in, will the cost of utes go up, as some are predicting?
I think there's going to be a lot of people in there who can easily make use of some of these upcoming electric utes. And at the end of the day, I don't think there's many people who'd miss necessarily not having a ute. There'll be alternatives there.
First tonight to Washington, D.C., where the American President Joe Biden has delivered his third State of the Union speech at the U.S. Capitol.
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
The President was met with huge applause from Democrats as he sought to show he can still deliver a stirring speech.
Good evening. If I were smart, I'd go home now.
This year, his address was being watched even more closely than usual, with the president needing to promote himself and his policies to American voters before the election in November. It's now all but certain he'll face his predecessor, Donald Trump. Mr. Biden focused on his domestic priorities, but also raised America's role in the conflicts in Gaza and Ukraine. The ABC's North America Bureau Chief, Jade McMillan, was in the chamber for the State of the Union address. Jade, watching this speech on TV, it seemed to be even more of a spectacle than usual. There were standing ovations, heckling, special guests. What was it like to be in the chamber at the Capitol?
Well, there's so much tradition and theatre really associated with the State of the Union. This is an annual address to Congress, but also to the nation with millions of Americans watching on from home. So in an election year, especially, the stakes for Joe Biden were very high. There was a real sense of anticipation in the chamber ahead of his arrival, members of Congress posing for photos. Some made very deliberate choices in what they wore. Members of the Democratic Women's Caucus, for example, sitting together, all wearing white to send a message over reproductive rights. And while this does happen every year, it is pretty extraordinary to see up close all three branches of the US government coming together at once. The president obviously coming down to address Congress on Capitol Hill, and justices of the Supreme Court coming in to listen to that address as well. So there was applause for them as they arrived. Once Joe Biden started speaking, though, the response largely fell down party lines. Many Democrats rising to their feet after every few paragraphs or so to applaud Joe Biden, to occasionally chant the phrase, four more years. Republicans, on the other hand, were a lot quieter than that, apart from the occasional interjection, some heckling of the president also.
The war in Gaza was a crucial issue for the president to address. Muslim voters in some crucial states don't want to support him because of his administration's backing of Israel. What did he say about that conflict in his speech?
Well, this is an issue that Joe Biden has come under increasing pressure over, and we saw that on the streets of Washington, D.C. tonight. People are going out to protest Joe Biden's handling of the war in Gaza as he was making his way from the White House to Capitol Hill. And once he got inside the chamber, there was anger expressed towards him there too. A few members on his own side, Democrats, including Rashida Tlaib, the only Palestinian American member of Congress, held up signs, small signs at various points of Joe Biden's address with messages along the lines of lasting ceasefire now and stop sending bombs. Now, the president had really talked up hopes of achieving at least another temporary ceasefire by now. Those hopes haven't been realised. And so in his speech, he instead sought to emphasise the work of his administration in trying to get humanitarian aid into Gaza. And he announced that the US would work to establish a temporary port, a pier off Gaza's coast, to get further aid shipments in. He also spoke about the suffering of Palestinian civilians, and he had this message for Israel.
For the leadership of Israel, I say this: humanitarian assistance cannot be a secondary consideration or a bargaining chip. Protecting and saving innocent lives has to be a priority. As we look to the future, the only real solution to the situation is a two-state solution over time.
And Jade, it's all but certain that Donald Trump will be Mr. Biden's opponent in the presidential election in November. What did the president have to say about him?
Well, he didn't directly refer to Donald Trump by name, but there was no question over who the target was of some of his most pointed remarks. Joe Biden criticised Mr. Trump over his position on issues like reproductive rights in the wake of Roe v. Wade falling a couple of years ago that had enshrined a national right to abortion. That has become a major issue for Democrats, and it's going to focus heavily on Joe Biden's campaign. He also again argued that Donald Trump presents a threat to American democracy. He mentioned the January 6 attack on the US Capitol, and he really sought to draw a contrast between himself as a leader and that of his predecessor.
My fellow Americans, the issue facing our nation isn't how old we are, it's how old are our ideas. Yeah. Hate, anger, revenge, retribution are the oldest of ideas. Yeah. But you can't lead America with ancient ideas that only take us back.
Now, in that comment and in others, Joe Biden referring there to his age, he would be aware that there is concern being expressed by voters as to how old he is and his capacity to do the job. He is 81 years old at the moment. If he wins the election, he would be 86 by the end of a second term. So he at times sought to almost make light of that. He said that at various points throughout his very lengthy political career, he had been described as both being too young when he started and then too old. And he kind of came back to that argument that it's not about age, it's about how you do the job, and arguing that he is better placed to fulfill that role of President of the United States than Donald Trump is.
Jade McMillan is the chief of the ABC's North America Bureau. Well, observers of American politics around the world were watching Joe Biden's State of the Union address closely. Victoria Cooper is the research editor at the US Studies Centre at the University of Sydney.
I think the first issue that he really pushed was this idea of democracy being at risk, not only overseas, but also at home. That's been a really key theme of his State of the Union addresses since 2022, since the Russian invasion of Ukraine. He's often said that America needs to prove itself as a democracy, prove that democracy can work. And also he's kind of using this as a message to say that democracy is at risk under Donald Trump. So that's sort of the first issue that he really pushed hard. I think the other one is about abortion access and abortion rights. Biden made very clear that he blames his predecessor Donald Trump for the overturning of Roe v. Wade and the sort of patchwork of abortion laws that now face the United States. And he said, as a campaign promise, that if Congress was to put down legislation to make Roe v. Wade and abortion protection a national law, he would sign that. So he knows that that is a particular issue that drives Democratic voter turnout and could serve him well in November. And I think the last sort of policy that he really emphasized, and this is related to the first point, is foreign policy. I think that's something that Biden really stands apart with Donald Trump. Very early on, he mentioned Trump's comments that he said that Putin could do whatever he wanted with NATO allies. And Biden is kind of leveraging people's concerns about the kind of disruption that Donald Trump might have in the international community to say that he's a responsible leader.
You mentioned how important it was for the president to put in a good performance in this speech. We know the polls are showing that Democrats and others who don't want to vote for Trump are concerned about Mr. Biden's mental and physical health. What did you think of his performance?
I was very, very impressed by Biden's performance today. You know, he parlayed with Republicans, he ad-libbed. I've heard commentators saying it's very clear he had his coffee and Weetabix this morning. He was just energetic and raring to go. And that's the exact kind of performance he really needed to sort of assuage concerns about his age and about his competency for the presidency. You know, he did deliver that speech incredibly forcefully. We heard Abe say that he's been practicing consistently over and over this speech so that he, you know, didn't have too many gaffes, but he still ad-libbed parts. You know, he shouted out particular Republicans at different times. He really showed himself to be energetic, and that is the image that the public really needs to be seeing.
Yes, there seem to be a couple of minor stumbles with the teleprompter and things like that. But from what I could see, there were no major gaffes or problems with his memory or the delivery of his speech. Is that what you saw as well?
Yeah, absolutely. That's right. And I think it says a lot that he addressed concerns about his age head on. You know, he said in the last sort of part of his speech three times over, you know, there's concerns about my age, there's concerns. And I think it's really important and a good tactic of his to kind of address those and say, he even said, you know, I joined the Senate at age 29 and people said I was too young. Now they're saying I'm too old. But what it's not about age for him. It is about proving that he can do the job. And I think that's something that he made a point of saying tonight.
You probably haven't had a lot of time to look at the response the speech is getting, but what's the word in the media and perhaps on social media as well? How are people responding to the speech?
Mostly the speech has been one of surprise. I think a lot of people, partly because of the image that that Joe Biden is getting in the media at the moment, suggests that he, you know, might not have been able to deliver a speech at all. And I think this just kind of reminds people that he's a similar calibre and the same president that was elected 4 years ago that wasn't too old at that point in time. So I think there's a huge amount of, I guess, restored confidence and excitement about what this campaign season might look like. I think some of us after the Super Tuesday elections were thinking, oh, what a snooze fest, Trump v. Biden again. It's going to be the same over again. But I think this particular speech and this emphasis on comeback has actually been really energizing. It's been this kind of signifier that it's the start of Biden's campaign, not the end. And that, you know, if he continues to deliver performances like this, maybe his fate will change in the polls and he might be able to restore some public confidence.
Victoria Cooper from the US Studies Centre at Sydney Uni. As we heard a little earlier, Mr. Biden has used the State of the Union address to outline his plan to order the US military to establish a temporary port on the Gaza coastline. It'd be used to help deliver food and other humanitarian aid to civilians living under Israel's bombardment of the enclave. But the American leader has stressed building that infrastructure won't require the deployment of US troops to the region. This report from Nick Grimm.
Hunger and desperation are growing inside Gaza, where what aid gets in does little to ease the duress faced by civilians like this woman, living in a makeshift camp for the displaced. I do not have a house, she says. All my children are ill. I'm having to beg for medicine. The UN and aid organisations are warning there could soon be an explosion in preventable deaths from malnutrition and disease unless more aid can be allowed inside Gaza. UNICEF's James Elder.
When you put so much work into getting a convoy of medicines, of life-saving nutritious food, of water, and then again at the 11th hour, it's blocked. And it will get worse until we get a ceasefire and can flood the Gaza Strip with life-saving aid.
The Israeli government says it's not imposing any restrictions on aid and has blamed poor UN distribution for the shortages. And after 4 days of talks in Cairo, ceasefire negotiations between Israel and Hamas remain deadlocked. With little sign of progress between the warring sides, the US president has told the American people he has tasked his military with building a temporary pier on Gaza's coastline to allow the unloading of supplies.
Tonight, I'm directing the US military to lead an emergency mission to establish a temporary pier in the Mediterranean on the coast of Gaza. that can receive large shipments carrying food, water, medicine and temporary shelters.
But with no US troops to set foot inside Gaza and with little detail on how the aid will be distributed, the plan is already attracting criticism from leading US Republicans. Senator Marco Rubio has told Fox News it's a dangerous concept.
Once you get aid in, who's going to distribute it? Because that's really the factor in place right now. The only people on the ground with any organization to distribute things are Hamas.
This is not an ideal solution. It's going to take several weeks to build a port.
Sir Mark Lyle Grant is a former British diplomat. He's speaking here to the BBC.
But nonetheless, it is a sign that the Americans want to do something to alleviate the humanitarian crisis and a sign perhaps that they think this conflict is going to go on for several months.
Yeah. Aid organisations have welcomed the plan, but insist the only real solution to end the suffering of Palestinian civilians inside Gaza rests on more aid trucks crossing its borders.
Look, the United States has the lifting capacity if it really sets its mind to it.
Tim Costello is a former CEO of World Vision Australia, now director of the advocacy group Ethical Voice. He believes the US effort to get aid inside Gaza is a positive step, but the need for a massive logistical exercise remains.
When you deliver humanitarian relief of this scale, you are pulling together the sectors of construction because people need shelter and they've just been through a winter and they're cold. You need certainly water and food. You need temporary hospitals and the medicines and the staff to staff those hospitals whilst people are literally homeless, abandoned and without shelter and medical services.
Tim Costello is a former CEO of World Vision Australia. He's now the director of advocacy group Ethical Voice. That report from Nick Grimm. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. Just a reminder, you can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. Today is International Women's Day and it's been marked by rallies across the country. Speakers have used the occasion to argue that far more needs to be done to achieve equal rights, especially when it comes to pay packets and housing. This report from Isabel Massali.
As union members gathered at Parliament House in Perth, some workplace changes were celebrated, but mostly crowds warned of just how far Australia has to go.
Well, it's just about time, really, for women to be recognised as equal citizens in this country and around the world.
You don't see it that way?
No, I really don't, especially when women are underpaid, undervalued. We do far more work in the home in general. We're not recognised for caring for family and sick family members and children, all that unpaid extra work that gets unrecognised.
Nazim is an engineer working in the mining industry. While she pushes for equality in the workplace, she also wants Australians to think about issues overseas, including honour killings and female political prisoners.
Every corner of the globe, when a woman stands up for change, we are all connected and we have to support that. So my heart goes today to my sisters in Iran, my original country, which are standing up for change and equality.
Government data puts Australia's gender pay gap at about 20%. And recently, that data was made public for individual Australian companies in the hope it'll add more pressure on employers. Emeritus Professor Sarah Charlesworth is an expert on workplace regulation with a focus on gender.
It's what I call the gender equality tango. It's two steps forward and one step back and, you know, a couple of steps sideways. It's just I'm long enough in the tooth to remember the fight for paid parental leave, which we now have. It's just been extended. The government's now talking about superannuation being paid to parents who access paid parental leave. These are real considerable advances. So I think we really have to stop and take stock.
And Professor Charlesworth was impressed last year by amendments to the Fair Work Act.
At times it can seem quite glacial, but then, you know, then we see what for me was a fairly unexpected progressive move in employment regulation to actually insert the achievement of gender equality in the workplace as, you know, something the Fair Work Commission must consider both in national minimum wage fixing, but also in considering terms and conditions under award. So I think that is really something to celebrate, and I certainly celebrate that today.
But she says there's still a lot of work needed for the Fair Work Commission to achieve its goals.
So the irony is, often women will go after having children into casual part-time work because they need to work reduced hours. But the unfortunate trade-off is if they're casual, then they've got no access to paid leave. But even if they're permanent part-time and they get some low number of guaranteed hours, they can be asked to work more than that at ordinary time rates.
From the workplace to the home, Eliza Owens from CoreLogic has examined how Australian women compare when it comes to property ownership.
This year we learned from survey results that 68% of women own a residential property, whether it's their own home or an investment, and that's actually a little bit more than what we saw across males, which was an ownership rate of 67.4%. So there's pretty good parity when it comes to ownership of men and women of residential property.
But there's a catch.
My guess is that this is a reflection of people coupling up and owning homes together as they get older. It is worth noting, and again, this is out of the scope of this report, but for older women who do fall out of home ownership from divorce, or older women who maybe are single and don't get the chance to own property, they are probably some of the most vulnerable when it comes to re-entering the housing market and facing insecure housing.
Where there is a more stark gap in home ownership is in the much younger bracket of 18 to 29-year-olds. At that age, 52% of men own a home, compared to just 27% for women.
That report from Isabel Massali. Electric car makers are accusing Australia's peak automotive industry body of running a scare campaign to slow our transition to lower emission vehicles. American and Chinese car makers Tesla and Polestar have ended their memberships of the Federal Chamber of Automotive Industries in protest. They're accusing the chamber of deceiving the public with its claims the federal government's plan to reduce emissions will drastically push up car prices. John Daly has more.
The Federal Chamber of Automotive Industries claims the cost of a ute or four-wheel drive could rise by up to $13,000 under government plans to fast-track vehicle emissions reductions. Mary Nenke runs a farming business in WA's Great Southern region and still relies on diesel to get around. And the talk of more expensive vehicles worries her.
Absolutely, because, you know, distance is a huge concern. You know, I think it's extremely important that it's viable. And we shouldn't be penalised. We need more people in the bush, not less.
Would you conceive a future where you would be able to or be interested in using an electric vehicle on the farm instead of a fuel-powered one?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, one can never say no. You've got to actually see these things working and see that they've got the capacity that you need. It's a very difficult one, you know. At the moment, there's not a vehicle that we would look at.
The claims by the Federal Chamber of Automotive Industries, or FCAI, that prices for utes and four-wheel drives will rise significantly has caused some serious backlash from EV car makers. First, Tesla and now Chinese-owned EV maker Polestar have quit the membership of the chamber as a result. They accuse Australia's peak body for automotive industries of a deceptive campaign against the federal government's proposed new vehicle efficiency standard. Polestar Head of Communications, Larissa Mirabelli, told RN Breakfast the company has lost confidence in the peak body.
And so the FCAI's campaign so far really doesn't represent our position at all. And we believe it's done some serious damage to consumer perception and trust in this proposed policy.
The FCAI is opposing the government's preferred rollout for its new vehicle efficiency standard, called Option B, Fast and Flexible. It would begin in January next year and target a 60% reduction in average new car emissions by 2029. FCAI Chief Executive Tony Webber told Melbourne's 3AW the emission reductions in that plan are too fast.
Now we have a government that's come in and wants to have a fuel efficiency standard, so we agree on that. The problem is the level of ambition. And this scheme will start in under 10 months' time. And if you look at it, in years 26, 27 and 28, listen to how much improvement there has to be in those 3 years under our calculation. 17% in 26, 21% in 27, and 26% in 2028. And they compare our scheme with the US. We're not aware of any year in the US where they've got anywhere like 10%.
In a letter to Tony Webber, Tesla says the peak body has made claims against this policy that are demonstrably false and likely to deceive and mislead customers. Motoring journalist for EV Central, Toby Hagen, says FCAI is representing the interests of its biggest members, who are going to struggle to meet these emissions reductions.
I think the Federal Chamber of Automotive Industries is trying to take the easiest path for some of the biggest car makers that it represents, and you could put Toyota at the top of that list. Look, I think there have been some pretty heated meetings at the Federal Chamber of Automotive Industries over the last month or so, and I've heard some murmurs that some other car makers aren't particularly happy.
Toby Hagen says there aren't really any attractive EV offerings when it comes to utes and four-wheel drives right now, but he thinks that will change soon.
Yes, if the utes we have today do not change between now and 2029, they will end up being more expensive. They'll have fines applied to them, but the market will change. The technology will change. The offerings will change. Engineers are smart people. Car companies don't want to give up their sales, and at the end of the day, they'll do what they can to protect their share.
Motoring journalist Toby Hagen ending that report from John Daly. The tiny plastic particles known as microplastics are found everywhere, from the summit of Mount Everest to the bottom of our oceans. They're also in our food and drinking water, and as a result, the particles have been discovered in the human bloodstream. Experts have been meeting in Adelaide today to find solutions to this public health challenge, as Angus Randall reports.
When we're all gone, it's the plastic that will remain. Mark Taylor is Victoria's chief environmental scientist.
Microplastics are everywhere. So they're in our clothing, they're in our homes, we're breathing it and we're ingesting it. It's in virtually every single product. You'll probably brush your teeth this morning with a plastic toothbrush. And so did I. And so, you know, we're all part of the problem.
Flinders University in Adelaide South is hosting the first national conference dealing with micro and nanoplastic. That's any piece of plastic smaller than half a centimetre. It's bringing together the country's best minds who are all working on ways to measure, capture and ultimately destroy these tiny pieces of plastic. Associate Professor Melanie McGregor is co-leading the conference.
It's a bit like asbestos and lead. You know, you need to start talking about it for things to start happening, for the government, the communities to start saying, OK, what should we do? And listen to the experts.
There's really no way to escape microplastics. Research from Macquarie University has found more than a third of dust particles collected at home are made up of microplastics. It's still not clear what harm microplastic can do once it's in your body. Hayden Gillings is working on an answer.
It is quite scary because you've got organisations like the World Health Organization who have currently said that microplastics and nanoplastics are not a cause of concern at the moment, purely based on the fact that there's not enough information to say whether or not for certain that there is a risk.
He's investigating what happens to plastic when it gets into the bloodstream and whether our kidneys can filter it out.
We are hoping that, you know, the kidneys being the professionals at filtering that they are, we are hoping that they are able to expel them, which would be really useful, but yeah, it's just a matter of finding out whether they are recirculating in our system, whether they're collecting in the kidneys, or whether they are in fact being filtered out.
So what can you do to reduce your microplastic output? Your laundry forms a major part of household microplastic creation. Every time you run a load of washing, small microfibers will rub off clothes and can eventually end up in the ocean. Karen Jones-Hauser is from the Good Side Project.
With my business, I started making things from recycled plastic, and one of the first items was towels. And I thought I was doing a good thing. They're made from recycled polyester and nylon. But then I learnt about microplastics. And with every load of wash, up to 700,000 invisible microplastics are going into waterways. And that's with every wash.
Later this year, she'll release a filter that can catch these microfibres. She says it's the first Australian-made solution to this problem.
So the filter sits on the outside. You take the pipe that would normally go into the drain in your waterways and you attach that to the filter. It simply goes in, the microplastics are caught, the fresh water goes out, and that's what goes out into the waterways.
This filter removes plastic from the water supply, but for the moment, that filtered material will still end up in landfill, and there's no easy way to recycle microplastic. One solution could be to eat our way out of the problem. David Thompson's company Alchemy is developing a way to encourage bacteria to eat plastic and turn it into energy.
We can actually do a simple process to the plastics and make common garden variety bacteria find it attractive and transpose it from its toxins to something that's more environmentally friendly. It's biogas and compost.
The end goal would be for waste operators to have plastic-eating bacteria on site, preventing material from going to landfill or breaking down into microplastic. It's expanding into larger trials this year.
Angus Randall. And that's PM for this week. Thanks for your company. I'm Samantha Donovan. I hope you have a great weekend.